For our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners, the North Carolina Reading Service now presents... Indie Week. That is to say, The Independent, and I'm John Federson, to read you this week's issue, dated October the 30th of 2025. And the elections are coming up, November the 4th. And we better get some more articles about those elections in various areas from Indy Week. First, from Durham, this came in this morning. Bell and Williams square off in mayoral debate. In a packed auditorium at NC Central University on Tuesday, the Campus Echo hosted this Durham municipal elections only mayoral debate. While Anjanae Bell and Leo Williams have met in forums through the primary, it was the only opportunity they had to appeal to voters in a head-to-head format before November 4th. The candidates agreed on issues including fare, free buses, and increased support for the arts, and had their biggest disagreements over a controversial development proposal in the historic Hayti community, approaches to crime, and whether or not Williams is overly dismissive of residents' concerns about overtaxation. They also dug into homelessness, the city budget, downtown parking, student housing, and more. And here are our biggest takeaways from the debate. Bell had a tougher assignment. As it is for all challengers, the onus had been on Bell this election season to prove to voters that she is worth bucking the incumbent. Williams, who is seeking a second term as mayor, coasted through the primary with about 55% of votes to Bell's 30%. Since then, she's surely been hoping to flip some Williams primary voters, pick up some votes from the less successful primary candidates. Pablo Friedman, for example, pulled a solid 12% and win over some new voters who sat out the primary. Bell has sought to consolidate anti-Williams sentiment among some of the city's politicos and council watchers by going after the mayor for his development-friendly attitude. Since she's the challenger, she's able to criticize works on the city council. "There are issues on council with your leadership," she said. But it also means she can't tout a governance record of her own. After the debate, she told Indy that her main message to voters was commitment, saying, "Commitment is important in leadership in this city, being accountable, listening to answer the questions, not going off somewhere else to deflect. I think staying committed, no matter how uncomfortable it might have been, that was important for me, and I hope that authenticity is what the audience got from me tonight." She said she hoped that anyone hearing her speak for the first time went home feeling fired up about getting involved. Similarly, Williams said that he hoped debate goers heard something that would inspire them to go vote. He told Indy after, "I hope they will do their homework, look at who they should vote for, and I hope that they will have vision for the city and vote for the candidates that have vision, such as myself and Mark Anthony Middleton." Next, development was front and center. The clearest division was on that Heritage Square rezoning case. Bell has previously criticized Williams for his handling of the request, which would have included a 10-story office building, 2 8-story life science facilities, 27,000 square feet of retail space, and roughly 400 residential units. The developer hosted over 50 stakeholder meetings with residents and community groups, steadily compiling a list of potential community proffers. Still, opponents who packed the city council chamber over the summer said the proffers didn't go far enough to ensure the development would benefit rather than harm the surrounding community. They spoke, "It's always people over profit for me and the voices of Hayti." They spoke clearly, said Bell at the debate, as she criticized Williams for not moving forward with a public hearing on the rezoning after the developer pulled the request in a surprise move. Quote, this leadership could not stand with courage to allow the people to speak. Williams, in his response, listed some of the benefits that the city negotiated with the developers, including scholarships for NC Central students and space designed for women-owned businesses. Williams said, it would have expanded so many jobs and so much revenue for the city. It was 3 years of community engagement. What hurts me is, what do we have now? Nothing. Next, it's the economy, stupid. Like development, taxes, and the cost of living are always at the center of local elections, Williams was on message with his plug of an innovation center, the Signature Capital Improvement Project, which he says will revitalize a downtown that has been slow to regain the foot traffic it lost during COVID. He told the crowd, we're not the third largest city in North Carolina, but we have the smallest convention center. We lost $72 million in denied contracts because of capacity. His pitch is to create a space that can also be used by students and local companies to avoid any slump in revenue when conventions aren't in town. He said adding those spaces could raise sales tax revenue, helping keeping the burden off residential taxpayers. Bell said she was not on board with the center because there are better uses for that investment. She pointed out the downtown parking costs as a good starting point, arguing those costs are discouraging people from visiting downtown and spending money. It's impacting business, she said. It's impacting our ability to generate additional revenue. She also said that some people have concerns about safety and that more lighting could help. The candidates also addressed the cost of housing for students specifically. NCCU's enrollment grew by 13.5% in the past year, making it the fastest growing school of the 17 UNC system campuses. That brought the school up to about 8,000 enrolled students and has left the campus, per their chancellor Carrie Dixon's earlier comments, bursting at the seams. Bell said she would partner with nonprofits and local developers to repurpose vacant commercial spaces through the city, while Williams said that he would focus on building relationships between developers and the university. Final section of this, the real winner was NC Central and its students. Both candidates were determinedly on message. Both fell short of any stellar breakout moments, and both avoided any obvious gaffes. Though they did have one especially tense exchange when Bell accused Williams of dismissing residents' concerns about affordability without apology. Bell, you made a comment to an elderly woman about not knowing how to do math. Williams, I do not remember telling someone they don't know how to do math. NCCU students, though, made an impressive showing, both in hosting the cycle's only debate and in filling an auditorium on Tuesday night to hear about local politics. The moderator, Ronnie Butts from the Campus Echo, respectfully kept the candidates on topic and the conversation moving with a thoughtful series of questions. The organizers swiftly and professionally removed a heckler who repeatedly interrupted the first few minutes of the debate. Hosting a debate also helps boost the school in the municipal conversation. The candidates, both NCCU alum, paid a reasonable amount of lip service to their Eagle accreditations. Bell, in her opening remarks, I see you. I was you. You are the thinkers, the innovators, the truth tellers, the bridge builders who may help decide what Durham becomes next. She also discussed plans to help students get work experience within Durham. Williams, later in the debate, mentioned a proposal for a designated university to downtown bus line and suggested that the city could help sponsor a homecoming concert in the future. Continuing the Durham Municipal, there are 2025 endorsements, and I have read some of these endorsements in a previous article for the primary election. Now, Durham mayor in the Ward 1, 2, and 3 city council seats. All the candidates we originally endorsed for the primary have made it through to the general. Durham's voters have the option to maintain or make significant changes to the city council with 4 of 7 seats on the ballot. Whoever is elected will, over the next few years, make consequential decisions about the city's future, and they'll do so in an increasingly complex and fraught political climate. Here again are our picks for mayor and Durham City Council. And listeners, I have simply cut out all many of the details which came from the endorsements for primaries, and just continued with the fairly plain and simple endorsement listing. Mayor Leonardo Williams. City Council Ward 1, Matt Kopeck. City Council Ward 2, Shanetta Burris. And City Council Ward 3, Chelsea Cook. Now, I'm going to make an exception for City Council Ward 2 because, as they say, ahead of the primary, we elected not to make an endorsement in this race. Over the past few weeks, we've gathered additional information and want to provide readers with an informed recommendation as they head back to the polls. We still have reservations about Mark Anthony Middleton. Since trailing challenger Shanetta Burris in the primary by 10 percentage points, he stood by his record. Quote, I've been elected twice in this city, pretty impressively. I haven't done it by talking differently or changing my message or policy, he told the Indy on primary night. We appreciate Middleton's focus on gun violence, his institutional and policy knowledge, and insistence on logical decision-making. And if those things appeal to you, you should consider him. But as in the primary, his voting record on rezoning cases and the trust he's lost among some residents who have advocated to the city council prevent us from issuing an endorsement. Burris made an impressive showing in the primary, turning out big numbers against an incumbent, despite raising the least money of any candidate. Since the primary, we've learned more through additional conversation about her years of organizing in the community and real-world knowledge of housing policy. She has spoken thoughtfully about ensuring city programs aimed at promoting housing affordability are actually working, and about how building trust in local government, especially at a time when confidence in federal and state government is low. Some interactions we've heard about or witnessed during our reporting this season, and the fact that Burris did not file any required campaign finance reports until we inquired about them in mid-October, gave us pause. But we're hopeful she will follow through on her pledges to be both community and data-informed in development decisions, and to build coalitions across different perspectives on issues affecting Durham. And we think she deserves a shot, and we endorse her for Ward 2. A very substantive article is next, and it is about Western Wake County, and it's about Chinese-American candidates who are running strong town council campaigns. This is a 4-page article, the way I see it now. And here we go. Bella Huang, a candidate for Cary's District C Town Council seat in the municipal election this fall, tells a story about her son's piano teacher who lives close by and is supporting Huang's campaign with a sign in her yard. She says the musician, quote, a strong Trump supporter, surprised neighbors with the yard sign for Huang, a Democrat, in an officially nonpartisan race. Huang's opponent, Renee Miller, is active in the local Republican Party. It's just one example, Huang says, about how she's been able to build bridges with a diverse electoral base and head into early voting as the top fundraiser out of all 6 candidates running in Cary this cycle. She's reported a haul close to $100,000. According to the most recent filings available, $30,000 ahead of the next most moneyed candidate. Huang says she supports her values, that's totally fine. But for the local election, she's just known me so many years. She knows I'm a good person, I really care about everyone, so she supports me no matter what. It makes me very proud to share this story. Wang is one of two Chinese American candidates running strong campaigns for municipal seats in western Wake County. The other, Su Mu, who is running for one of three open seats on Apex Town Council. Mu, as well, is leading in a pack of eight contenders in fundraising, netting close to $68,000, nearly four times that of her closest competitor. She says of her campaign, "We're out there, talking to the voters, talking to neighbors, attending all sorts of events to learn what our residents care about, what their concerns are, and what the government can do better." It's no coincidence that Wang and Mu are making waves in local elections this year. Both have the weight of the Margin of Victory Empowerment Fund. That's a political action committee known as Move NC behind them. Move NC is dedicated to encouraging political engagement among Asian Americans and championing Asian American candidates. Wang and Mu have been able to tap into a considerable donor base associated with this PAC. They also have role models, including former Chapel Hill Town Council member Hongbin Gu and State Representative Yao Liu, a former Cary Town Council member who ran successful campaigns. Liu and Wang say they're learning from. Gu and Liu are two of the first Chinese Americans to hold elected office in North Carolina. Finally, they have the support of many in a small but growing Chinese American population in Wake County, the Triangle, and the state more broadly. Residents and voters who have been galvanized to fight back against the anti-immigrant rhetoric of President Trump, and specifically the anti-Chinese sentiment that followed the outbreak of the COVID pandemic. Shruti Parikh, the Director of Education and Political Engagement at the North Carolina Asian Americans Together, that's a nonpartisan nonprofit group that works to foster civic engagement and political participation among Asian Americans in the state, says, "And so they mobilized. They created their Move NC PAC, which allows them to work together to ensure that their interests are funded. But it's taken a while, at least a generation, to get here." North Carolina's Chinese American population, which represents about 15% of the state's overall population of Asian American Pacific Islander residents, began growing in the 1990s and continues to grow, according to the census data and American Community Survey data. As of 2023, North Carolina is home to more than 360,000 AAPI, that's Asian American Pacific Islander, residents, including more than 52,000 residents of Chinese origin. Most Chinese American residents, about 45% collectively, live in Wake, Durham, or Orange counties, with the largest population around 14,000 residing in Wake County. Parikh says she does not see that growth or the community's involvement slowing. She says, "I'm talking to more and more Asian Americans across the state and from different Asian American backgrounds that are interested in running for office. They see that others have blazed that trail ahead of them, and they know that with that success, that means they can also bring their community's interests forward and make sure they have a seat at the table as well." In 1882, the National Chinese Exclusion Act specifically barred Chinese laborers from immigrating to the United States and blocked Chinese immigrants from becoming U.S. citizens. Later, the U.S. Immigration Act of 1924 instituted four decades of racist national origin quotas that limited immigration from Asian and African nations. But in 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Immigration and Nationality Act, ushering a new era that saw the quotas erased, skilled immigrants prioritized, and family reunification as a basis for immigration emphasized. By the 1980s, North Carolina and the United States as a whole began to see increased migration from non-Western European nations, according to Nathan Dollar, the executive director of Carolina Demography at UNC Chapel Hill. During the 1980s through the 2010, he says, some 70% of all immigrants to the United States and North Carolina came from Latin America and Asian countries. Of the AAPI communities, Indian Americans, who comprise the largest subgroup of Asian Americans in the state, quickly became the most politically organized, founding a nonpartisan PAC called NC Impact three decades ago, according to Parikh. They have secured leadership positions within the state Republican and Democratic parties and Indian Americas, and Americans like Morrisville Town Council member Steve Rao and State Senator Jay Chaudhuri have seen widespread electoral success at the state and especially local levels. This election cycle, several Indian American candidates are running for seats on the Morrisville Town Council, including mayor. People of Indian descent make up a majority, some 40%, of Morrisville's population. Additionally, AAPI candidates are running for local office in Apex, in addition to Moo and Wake Forest, this cycle. Gu, a former Chapel Hill Town Council member who was elected in 2017 and is one of the founders of the Move NC PAC, recalls moving to the States in 1994. Quote, "When I arrived in this country, there weren't really any Chinese or Asian organizations, so it took a long time for us to gradually reach the point we are now in." Gu says community organizations slowly began to come together for Chinese American residents in the Triangle, including the Chinese American Friendship Association, CAFA, a nonprofit cultural exchange group founded in 1996, and the Chinese School in Cary, founded in 2003. Events like the Chinese New Year's Gala and Cary's Chinese Lantern and Taste of China festivals brought Chinese American residents together and facilitated connections between immigrants and the wider community. On the state level, Asian American nonprofits like NCAAT, which formed in 2016, and various PACs, such as NC Impact, existed to foster civic engagement and mobilize AAPI voters. It was a massive effort, explains Parikh. Following its formation, an NCAAT survey found 80% of Asian Americans said they had never been contacted by either party in an election. Parikh says, "So we set out to bridge that gap. They phone banked, knocked on doors, set up a hotline, and sent out mailers in 8 different languages. There are between 20 and 25 spoken in the state's AAPI community." Parikh says, "In every election since 2016, we have worked hard to make sure that Asian Americans are increasingly aware of what elections are being held that year. The rise in voting numbers definitely shows our engagement has been successful." In the 2024 general election, 90,000 Asian voters cast ballots, according to the Board of Elections data. In 2020 and 2016 general election, those numbers were 75,000 and 51,000, respectively. It was around 2016, after Trump's election, that Gu says it began to crystallize for her that, along with community organizations, Triangle Chinese Americans needed a political voice, saying, "We came from a country that does not have the democratic system, so we know how important it is. So we are just willing to put in our efforts, our resources, to make sure we're working together with other community members and others who believe in this vision for America." Gu was elected to Chapel Hill's Town Council in 2017, the first person of Chinese American heritage elected in North Carolina's history. Then in 2019, Yao Liu was elected to Kerry's town council. In 22, Liu was elected to the state house in District 21, representing Western Wei County with 68% of the vote. Xi is the first Chinese American elected to a North Carolina legislative seat, and along with Wake County Representative Maria Serrania, who is of Filipino descent, one of two of the first Asian American women to serve in the legislature. In 23, Liu, Gu, Bella Huang, and a group of Chinese Americans living in the Triangle launched Move NC. The PAC's name came to Gu while she was running in the woods one morning, she says. While Asian Americans make up a small number of voters, she reasoned, so many elections across North Carolina at all levels of government are decided by small margins. She says, if we can encourage more people from the Asian American communities to get involved, do our voter registrations and education seminars, lots of training, and make sure people understand the issues, how important they are to their daily life and to their children, to the community, we can make a difference. In addition to supporting Asian American candidates and others who share the PAC's values, Move NC has fundraised for NC Governor Josh Stein, Attorney General Jeff Jackson, and Lieutenant Governor Rachel Hunt in past cycles. Move NC also lobbies for and against legislation in North Carolina and elsewhere that impacts their communities. Discriminatory laws in states like Florida ban Chinese nationals from owning property. North Carolina lawmakers filed a similar bill this session targeting Chinese citizens in attempt to prohibit them from owning property, which Move NC has opposed. The bill is currently stalled in the State House. Despite an emergent open hostility toward immigrants in the U.S. following the Trump re-election, the Asian American community is not a political monolith. Parikh of NCAAT says there's been a rise in Asian conservatism, and we saw an influx of that with misinformation and disinformation on WeChat channels last year. WeChat, similar to WhatsApp, is used widely in Chinese communities. I think that might be another contributing factor as to why we're seeing Chinese Americans running on a more progressive platform. Bella Huang and Su Miu are two candidates trying to make a difference, and they have a lot in common. Besides being Chinese American women and Move NC PAC members, Miu is PAC chair and Huang, a co-founder, serves on the executive board. They are both small business owners, working mothers, and community volunteers. But while bankrolled by many of the same donors, they are running different races. In Kerry's, as Huang's story about her piano teacher might suggest, District C is one of the town's older and more conservative districts. Although endorsed by the Wake County Democratic Party, Huang hasn't made much of her party affiliation this election cycle. She tells Indy, I just joined the Democratic Party when I registered my driver's license at the DMV. Huang says issues voters care about, including Kerry's Asian American residents, who make up slightly more than 20% of the population, include education, having good schools for their children, and housing for teachers so they can afford to live in the town. Huang says we don't have enough teachers, and I think that is one big issue. For the Asian American community, Huang says government services are another important concern. We care a lot about the parks, community centers, she says. Can we have enough pickleball or other community programs for us? And she adds, people here will be a little bit worried about the increasing cost of living and increased price of housing, which is not only in Asian American communities, it's the whole community that's worried about it. In Apex, Mu is more upfront about her political affiliation. She's running on the slate with two other Democrats, candidate Shane Reese and the incumbent mayor pro tem Ed Gray, all three of whom have been endorsed by the County Democratic Party. is also upfront about the difficulties of running as an Asian American candidate. She says she's received harassing comments directed at her and her campaign, mostly anonymously online. She says, because I'm an immigrant and a woman of color, some people make nasty comments about my campaign, questioning my qualifications. She holds a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering and an MBA in finance. They've never asked any other candidates, only me. Where were you raised and born? Recently, some people even left a comment about early voting. Are you a U.S. citizen? Mu released a statement on October the 6th addressing the comment. Quote, these experiences only strengthen my resolve to keep bringing people together with respect, compassion, and courage to make our country stronger and ensure APEX remains a welcoming home for everyone. I'm running to serve, unite, and empower all residents of APEX. Since then, Mu received about 45 more donations, she says, with 38 of those coming from APEX residents. Those donations will be reported in the upcoming campaign finance filing period, which posts before Election Day. Mu says she was heartened to see APEX residents stand up for her. They defended me, she says. Those nasty comments and people behind those comments are rare. Most APEX residents are friendly. They appreciate how our immigrants can contribute to this country, how much we do, and they appreciate we are hard-working people who contribute. So I feel touched. She says if she gets elected, she'll try her best to make APEX a welcoming place for everyone, regardless of your skin color, regardless of who you love, regardless of which ethnic group you belong to, saying it's the best place. I love APEX so much. There's no other place I'd rather call home. Over to Kerry now. The Kerry Town Council's candidates' mass mailers look suspiciously like official town documents. Kerry Town Council candidate Marjorie Eastman is sending out misleading campaign mailers that criticize her opponent, at-large incumbent member Carissa Cohen-Johnson, on a letterhead that imitates official Town of Kerry branding. The mailers come in an envelope emblazoned with a logo similar to the Town of Kerry's trademark logo and the words, Urgent! Property tax increase notice. Immediate action required. The letter inside begins with a warning. This is your official notice. Property taxes are going to increase. Before noting that it was paid for by the Friends of Marjorie K. Eastman Campaign Committee. Town of Kerry Chief Strategy Officer Susan Moran told Indy that a few residents have contacted the town to complain about the mailers. Moran wrote in an email, while the campaign materials do look a lot like Kerry's trademark logo and therefore likely and unfortunately give recipients an initial false impression that the mailer is official town business, there are enough differences for this parody or knockoff to be acceptable under First Amendment protections. At this point, our response is limited to simply addressing comments and inquiries we're getting from what is, so far, a handful of annoyed citizens. A spokesperson for the NC State Board of Elections confirmed to Indy the mailer does not violate any state policy since it includes a disclosure that it is a campaign communication. The mailers contain a handful of inaccurate statements about the Town of Kerry's budget and taxes. Indy asked Eastman to provide more evidence or context, but in a written statement, which she requested that the Indy include in full, Eastman did not offer any new information in support of her claims and made additional claims about Cohen-Johnson that the Indy was unable to verify. We fact-checked the statements in this mailer below. Property taxes are going to increase. That is true. The property taxes are increasing from 32.5 cents to 34 cents per $100 valuation in fiscal 26. Your town councilwoman, Carissa Johnson, voted to hike our property taxes, and if reelected, she will continue to increase the cost of living for families in Kerry. Cohen Johnson told India in September, I like to look my constituents in the eyes and tell them the truth. I don't see a path to avoid raising taxes because I won't pander and I will not lie to get a vote. I don't see a path forward without some modest tax increases because we have critical infrastructure work we absolutely have to do. Next, spending will increase 73%. There is no evidence to support this statement. The links to footnote 1 show trends in North Carolina median household income, which are unrelated to the town government spending that Eastman discusses here. Kerry's FY26 budget anticipates the town will spend $510 million this year. In 25, the town spent an additional $380 million. That's about a 34% increase, not 73. Garbage collection and other fees are going up. That is true. Kerry's solid waste and recycling fees from 23 to 26 per month per household this budget cycle, which is consistent with two decades worth of incremental fee increases. There's a town of Kerry fiscal year 26 budget, page 106, for more historical data. Property taxes will increase 25%. There is no evidence to support this statement. This footnote links to Indy's own reporting that Kerry Town Council unanimously voted to increase property taxes from 32.5% to 34% per 100 valuation. This is a 4.6% tax rate increase rather than 25%. If you want to stop high property taxes and town fees, then vote to defeat Carissa Johnson. The town council voted unanimously to raise these taxes by 1.5 cents this year, citing inflation, important projects, and a desire to maintain the current level of town services. Kerry joined Durham and Apex in raising taxes this year. Eastman did not respond to Indy's question about how specifically she would propose to keep the tax rate stable. We asked Eastman where she got her data and how she would propose to keep taxes stable if elected. In her response, she did not directly address those questions. Instead, she doubled down on her criticisms of Cohen Johnson and suggested that property tax exemptions for older homeowners would be one way to lower the tax burden on Kerry residents. She also noted that her campaign strategist, Paul Shoemaker, who also represents U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, helped her design the mailer. Even if Eastman was able to lobby the legislature to enact those exemptions, it's unclear how that would solve Kerry's budget crunch, since the town would presumably need to charge younger residents more to offset the exemptions or collect less tax revenue overall. Cohen Johnson wrote in a statement sent Friday to the Indy, Ms. Eastman clearly has a very active imagination and invents things out of convenience. Voters will choose my honest approach on election day because they're tired of pandering and being misled. Campaign finance records show Eastman is renting that post office box listed on her mailers from Kimberly Stonebreaker, former campaign manager for the far-right superintendent of public instruction candidate and Kerry resident Michelle Morrow. Stonebreaker was also the first treasurer for Eastman's campaign committee, though Eastman now has a different treasurer. During Morrow's 2024 run, the North Carolina Association of Educators sent her a cease and desist letter after she distributed red, apple-shaped campaign literature that resembled the NCAA's trademark palm cards, but instead made red Make Education Great Again. Stonebreaker did not respond to Indy's request for comment about the nature of her involvement in the Eastman campaign. Now, as I mentioned in this article, Marjorie Eastman insisted that Indy print this complete statement, which is three paragraphs, and I should go ahead and read that. The intent of my message is simple and sincere. Kerry families deserve to know that Clarissa Johnson is responsible for increasing property taxes for Kerry citizens and has clearly stated her intent to continue expanding spending, which means higher taxes for all of us. That's not fair to the people who worked hard to build their homes and lives here. As for my position, I oppose higher property taxes and will focus on tax relief. I care deeply about our community, and I believe it's wrong to keep asking families, seniors, and small business owners to shoulder a heavier tax burden year after year. If elected, I'll push for a change at the state level, for example, exploring how to allow Kerry to give exemptions to homeowners 75 and older on their primary residence, because no one should be taxed out of their home. Clarissa Johnson has said she wants Kerry to become the next Charlotte, but Charlotte has one of the highest tax rates in North Carolina. That's not the future I want for us. Kerry's strength comes from its people, not the government. We need leadership that values fiscal responsibility and fairness. We need leadership committed to letting hardworking citizens, regardless of age or station or life in life, keep more of their own money, not give more of it away. Well, that concludes both Marjorie Eastman's statement and this particular article. And back to Durham. This article released by Indie Week. 10/24, the 24th of October. Roxborough Mangum Redesign Plans Shape Up in Durham. Residents got a first look at possible designs for making Roxborough and Mangum streets in Durham two-way at an open house this week. The design concepts debut a big step forward in addressing two dangerous streets in Durham and one of transit advocates' top priority projects for reducing road deaths and injuries. Roxborough portion of the project stretches from Lakewood Avenue on the south side of downtown to Highway I-85 on the north end. Mangum Street portion also starts at Lakewood but ends at Markham Avenue. Construction is expected to begin in 2027. This year's budget includes $1.2 million from the city's capital improvement plan to move forward on the design process, but total costs are still unclear. Traffic lights, for example, can cost hundreds and thousands of dollars per signal, and other material costs could fluctuate based on tariffs and other national trends. Based on the designs shared at the open house on Tuesday, reconfiguring Roxborough and Mangum wouldn't require a ton of major construction. Large design renderings showed two-way traffic patterns, intersection redesigns with new stoplights to help control speeds, and curb adjustments for essential vehicles like fire trucks and buses. Attendees used sticky notes to leave comments or suggestions like protected bike lanes and roundabouts. By the way, this article includes some diagrams and maps of some of these projected changes. Attendees at the open house pointed out key issues like the downtown Durham Library, where five lanes of one-way traffic make it challenging for some residents to cross that wide intersection quickly and safely. Overall, folks who attended the open house said the two-way conversion seemed, quote, simple and a, quote, no-brainer. But while converting to two-way could reduce speeds and provide additional safety, advocates continue to push Durham Transportation Department and the NC Department of Transportation, which owns those roads, to include more bike and pedestrian infrastructure within the project. Scott Mathis, a Durham resident and avid cyclist who co-organizes the school bike train group ride in his neighborhood, I think the designs are a minimal improvement at best. I don't think it's going to make things easier for pedestrians or cyclists downtown. It doesn't add anything to bike infrastructure. It doesn't add anything to pedestrian infrastructure. Converting both roads back to two-way routes would be a return to Durham before urban renewal cleaved High T from downtown, like the program did in cities nationwide in the 50s and 60s. 100 years ago, not only could you drive in both directions up and down Mangum Street, but Durhamites could catch a streetcar bustling through the middle of the road. The sections of Roxborough and Mangum that would be reworked still cut through the heart of downtown Durham, but in the last two decades, residential homes have proliferated along most of the route. Some have staked signs in their yard that read, "Slow down," or "Children at play." Safety is a major concern for residents along the corridor, particularly for families of young children who are terrified by the breakneck speeds of cars whizzing by in the 35-mile-per-hour zone. A traffic analysis study of the project area prepared for the city showed between 2018 and 2023, Roxborough Street incurred 748 total crashes and Mangum 434. Only a small percentage of crashes involved pedestrians and cyclists that could be due to a low volume of travelers along the corridor using these methods due to safety concerns. The study also suggested that two-way conversion would, quote, result in an overall acceptable level of service at all the intersections, even during peak traffic hours. Advocates say corridors like Roxborough and Mangum and the nearby Duke Street and Gregson Street one-way pairing are dangerous for pedestrians and motorists alike. John Talmadge, executive director of Bike Durham, views the Roxborough-Mangum project as a symbol of Durham's commitment to reaching its goals for Vision Zero, a multinational movement to reduce traffic death and serious injuries. Talmadge told Indy last May during Bike Month, "Roxborough-Mangum is really a test case for whether there's a commitment to make physical design changes to some of our busier, dangerous streets. It feels like if they back away from this project, we don't have a lot of confidence they'll take on the other projects. They're all going to be hard. They're all going to be bigger dollar projects. So we think it's important that they see that through." Durham will ultimately need sign-off from NC Department of Transportation before any construction begins. The state passed its own Vision Zero resolution a decade ago, and in its most recent strategic plan, DOT laid out key metrics for meeting these goals: 50% reduction in the number of fatalities on public roadways by 2035 and 100% by 2050. Advocates like Mathis and Talmadge say the state should allow local municipalities like Durham to pursue major road reconfiguration if they are serious about hitting that mark on Vision Zero. As Durham continues to prioritize density and sustainability inside the urban core, city transportation and planning staff, as well as transport advocates, are pushing ways to de-emphasize single-occupancy vehicles in favor of public transit, biking, and walking. In larger cities, teens and young adults forego a driver's license because other transport options are easier and more accessible. Mathis says that his daughter and her friends are continuing that trend even in places like Durham, and that local officials should take note and plan for future generations. He said, "Up to now, we've been building a city for boomer culture and our grandparents and their parents. What we need to do is start rebuilding for our children and their children. Our children don't want to drive everywhere. We need to start working on cities that are safe to walk, safe to bike, and laid out for public transport. Individual, personal automobiles are on their way out, yet we continue to try to build for them, and that is a mistake. Now is the time. I mean, 20 years ago was the better time, but right now is the next best time." The conversion of Roxborough and Mangum isn't the only corridor being considered for a redesign. Public engagement is currently underway for Duke Street and Gregson, another state-owned one-way pair where many injuries occur. The city is also looking at updating traffic patterns on a number of state and city-owned roadways when those roads are resurfaced and repainted throughout the next year. During this resurfacing process, the Transportation Department could choose to paint in a new bike lane or other markings that don't require additional construction, saving money while also moving toward larger transportation goals. Lauren Grove is Durham's Vision Zero coordinator. They write, we're trying to move things along with urgency, but we are working within NCDOT parameters and essentially trying to bring them along with us. It sets a precedent for other conversions or other state-owned roads and how we address safety improvements on some of those bigger arterials like Duke and Gregson, like Holloway and Fayetteville, where we're hoping to turn those into transit emphasis corridors and make improvements. All of these are state-owned roads, so we're really trying to make an improvement in a system we really don't have the ultimate say in. All right, in most of the time left available for me today, in memoir, Beneath the Skin of Sorrow is a book release from Duke University Press by Nina Freeland. Moving lyrically through loss, writes Shelby Polk. When Nina Freeland feels overwhelmed, she gets busy. She says, no, that's not in the wrong order. The bigger the feelings, the more she packs onto her schedule. My normal go-to when I'm stressed is to get busy. I just do stuff. I'm a busy little bee. In the past 6 years, Freeland has experienced plenty to be overwhelmed by. In July 2019, her husband, renowned architect Phil Freeland, died of ALS. 6 months later, in January of 2020, her sister, Deborah Pierce, a hospice and palliative care physician, died of lung cancer. In between this massive sequence of losses, Freeland's beloved dog, Basie, passed away. Left alone in her newly quiet Durham home, Freeland, a celebrated jazz vocalist, initially wanted to pour herself into a demanding jazz tour, but then COVID-19 arrived, putting live music on hold. At first, Freeland didn't give up on the idea of a tour, but then, as, quote, a couple weeks turned into a couple months, turned into a couple of years, she said, she settled into a renewed creative practice. It was the quality of the quiet that allowed me a sort to lean into writing music. As a 7-time Grammy-nominated jazz musician, Freeland is no stranger to life-giving creativity. But in this era of mourning, the words just kept coming. Out of this period came a Grammy-nominated album, Time Traveler, a podcast, Great Grief, and, now out from Duke University Press this month, a book called Beneath the Skin of Sorrow, Improvisations on Loss. She says over video chat from her airy living room, I wrote my way out of depression, out of a sense of what is my life now? What use is it to consider myself as what I was? She wrote herself through the very uncomfortable transition period. I wasn't looking to write a book necessarily, but I was writing to save a life. Beneath the Skin of Sorrow is a collection of writings drawn from Freeland's journals. It's a bit hard to quantify, perhaps in part because Freeland herself had to find her way into a book by thinking of the process in terms of music. The book is broken into 4 movements, flowing improvisationally between anecdote and poem, a sci-fi-inspired short story, and a conversation with the personified grief. Freeland admits this structure was a problem for an early editor. Initially, she says she was resistant to the idea that the manuscript even was a book, but the more she shared bits and pieces with friends, the more they pushed her to share with the world. I was clutching my pearls, she says. It was her story, not anyone else's. It was really the love and support of friends who suggested that within the individual, personal, could lie the universal. She then leaned into the idea of improvisation as guiding philosophy, but still had no interest in writing a how-to book. In her experience, grief was a process you made up as you went along. Saying the book itself is the evidence that this is true, that an improvisatory relationship with grief can exist. You don't have to be a jazz musician. People do this all the time, but they don't call it that. Anyone who feels their way through grief with a sense of humility and an effort to listen to what nature or the world is trying to tell them is improvising their way through grief. She outlines some examples. She says they start a foundation for people who are in a similar situation. They volunteer with hospice. They give money to the American Cancer Society. They make a grief card. All these things are responses to the trauma of loss, and it is an improvisatory practice, but I didn't learn it in church. Nobody said you can dance with your grief. I never heard that. Didn't even hear it suggested as a good idea. Phil and Nina Freeland married in 1979 and settled in Durham soon after. It wasn't too long before they became a Durham arts power couple. Phil founded architecture firm The Freeland Group and designed buildings all over the country, from the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco to the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. The couple's three children, Dean, Maya, who provided work for the cover of Beneath the Skin, and Pierce, are all artists or academics who share their parents' passion for education and the arts. In Beneath the Skin of Sorrow, Freelance describes the way Phil encouraged her musical ambitions, refusing to let her use their family as an excuse to give up on jazz, and the way her roles of mother, wife, and artist intersected and fed each other. Phil's mark on Durham is undeniable. He designed downtown hallmarks like the Durham Bulls Athletic Park, Durham Station Transportation Center, and the Durham County Human Service Complex. Near the end of his life, the Freelands created the North Star Church of the Arts to safeguard a space for Durham's marginalized artists amid the city's rapid gentrification. When I ask Freeland how it feels to share Phil's legacy with, for example, anyone who's ever come to a Bulls game, she muses on the way grief can change your entire outlook on time. She says, "I'm reminded when I see his work and his legacy how important it is to live while blood is running warm in your veins, and how beautiful it is that his legacy exists still. And even that is in the process of decomposing and becoming something unrecognizable in hundreds and hundreds of years." Well, this issue of Indie Week is now headed to the history books. In fact, it's going into our podcast library after its initial broadcast on Friday. So, happy Halloween, folks, or happy whatever you want. John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service will be with you next week with the next edition of Indie Week. Thank you very much for listening. So long.